This is the Limitless, the podcast between. I'm Jason Halsey, and I'm talking once again to Gib Strange of Notes from Uncanny Valley.
Because we've been talking a lot about audiences and who is the audience, and I've been trying to imagine who your listeners are. do you know on that Cinema's second album, there's a track called Novelty Act. It was probably that title might have been a career defining. For Dead Cinema, but it opens with the line, Jason says, what's our target audience? But we've been, you and I have been sort of, I guess, kind of talking about trying to break through into a bigger audience, and even talking about it in terms of marketing demographics and stuff. What was my point? Do you have a sense of, I kind of have a vague sense of who I think is listening to you and why. Do you?
Well, of course I have a vague sense, but, well, I mean, it's based, I mean, I'm always trying to construct my sentences correctly, but, what makes it less vague is that I get feedback. And so essentially the more feedback I get, the more I can base my sense of the audience on feedback, on actual individuals that I've interacted with. And then it's only vague in the sense of it's, what's the word for that? It's not really representational, because I only get feedback. I only interact with a percentage of the audience. So I don't know about all the ones that are listening that I don't interact with.
Right. The lurkers like me. Like
you. Yeah. We've gone all the way to the other end of the spectrum. Yeah.
Well, go ahead.
No, go.
Well, that's sort of what I was basing it on, is reading through comments, which I'm doing more now. I don't think I used to look at your comments as much. And it's interesting to kind of, sometimes there'll be little disputes and you get a sense that there are people coming from different worlds. And
absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I sometimes have unpleasant experiences with listeners or readers, and insofar as, not necessarily that they're being unpleasant, but that I think, well, why do they listen to me? You know, like, I don't, like, even comments they didn't like that my conversation would leave them, I felt kind of defensive about that. Well, fuck off then, you know, if you don't like that, then you, it's like, it's childish. But and then they were commenting how much they liked the conversation with Kunstler. I'm like, well, but the conversation with Leatham was just as good, or better even, in my opinion. So, and that's the thing we were exploring with the aesthetic dissonance of our list, that just that thing, well, you know, if you, I want to feel I'm connecting to somebody deeply, and then there's a sort of literalization of what a deep connection might be by turning it into how much do they agree with me, which of course how much do they see the same, exactly same reality that I see,
right,
which isn't really the measure of a connection, and certainly not the only measure.
That's interesting. When I started taking pieces from notes from the Uncanny Valley to these read aloud writers workshops, and there was really quite a variety of people at the workshop. In other words, you know, there were a lot of people there who were writing Harry Potter fantasy stuff and, you know, historical fiction, you know, people who ordinarily I wouldn't think, you know, wouldn't be interested in their opinion.
Yeah.
I found very quickly that the humor in the pieces had a very broad appeal, or it was somehow, it was managing to bring in, you know, a real crossover audience that I hadn't even considered when I was alone in my studio apartment writing these perverse musings, you know. And I felt very, you know, like you're saying it, like, I feel like in earlier in my life, I would have been very turned off. Like, what am I doing wrong that I'm bringing in the mainstream crowd, you know?
Yeah.
But I was very pleased that to be reaching them, and I don't know, feel like that there was maybe something universal or close to universal about what I was talking about. Of course, you also think, well, maybe I am doing something wrong because they're not seeing exactly my intent, you know, and maybe they're missing some things and choosing to see other things. But,
Isn't it like any sort of dialogue? Obviously, it's different because it's one to many rather than one to one, but that we're not sure, we're never quite sure what we're communicating until we check with the person we're communicating with.
Yeah, that's true.
So, and then, yeah, go ahead. Oh,
I just was going to say, then you think of somebody like artists who used to, you know, I don't know, I guess I'm thinking like, you know, the kind of tortured artist mythologies that you grow up with, like a Kafka or a Van Gogh, and you think, they never got any fucking feedback. There was never anyone on the receiving end until after they died. And you think, well, how does that?
Well, and how does that tie into their being so legendary? Because, I mean, those two particular examples are, that's the pinnacle of the visual arts, Van Gogh, the painting, rather, and Kafka's practically the pinnacle of literary arts at this point. Mm. And so, yeah, if they were riding in a void, then, well, it does suggest like that they weren't influenced at all by public opinion. And that's something we admire, isn't it? This idea of an artist who's just completely true to their own voice.
Sure. Of course, also, though, you have Van Gogh's brother being very close to him, and, you know, Franz Kafka had Max Brod, so, you know, they had a tight inner circle that was, that they were writing or painting for, you know.
That's, presumably, yeah.
But, you know, most of my life I haven't felt like I've had that, you know.
Well, is that partly by choice, though? Because, like, even when I started writing, I mean, I started writing in my teens, but, or even younger, actually, but, I mean, if I trace back what I think of as my literary arc, it really began in earnest in my mid-20s, and it almost or not quite coincided with the internet. So almost as soon as I was writing more seriously, I was able to just put it online and at least get a few people reading it. And even in those early days, there were some email correspondences that came out of it, some that have continued to this day, or one at least, Phil Snyder, I met in that very early time. And so you could have also been doing that.
Yeah, that's true. I think I was very skeptical of the internet. Very afraid of it for a long time. I've sort of embraced it now, but yeah, that's a good point.
So skeptical and afraid. Right. Well, afraid because you're skeptical, or, well, I mean, are they two different things, or are they the same?
Feels like the same. I think I'm equating those in that.
So skeptical because anyone could do it, and it's just like self-indulgent potentially, or.
Well, there's that, yeah. But also, you know, the feeling of who's out there, who's watching, something kind of spooky about it, right?
The invisible audience. Yeah. Oh, I hadn't really thought of that correlation fully consciously until now, that this idea of working for an invisible audience in the sense of ancestors or angels or whatever, how it correlates with what we're doing anyway to a large extent, not literally, but and a different invisible audience with the internet. And how, well, I don't know, there's various things to be skeptical about that. I think that including the possibility that it doesn't exist at all unless you get feedback.
Mm.
Like you can count the numbers, which is an endlessly frustrating experience, but even if you do and it's not, you still don't know that they mean they could be bots. So.
Mm. Yeah. I had a dream when I was very young that is really like a literalization of what I was just telling you. And this was my first experience of sleep paralysis. I don't know if I told you that I had suffered from that sleep paralysis really bad. Did I tell you that?
I'm gonna say that you did, but I'm unsure because people keep telling me that they suffer from sleep paralysis, so I keep hearing it.
Mm.
So yeah, it's difficult for me to remember who said what. So anyway, but I'm interested.
Yeah, from about 14 to maybe 30 was very, very regular.
So I know, I think maybe you haven't then. So tell me the first thing anyway, what was it that you...
Well, this is interesting because it would have been before the internet. And the nightmare was, and it was very cinematic. It had a tracking shot in it, Jason. I was in my grandma's house, my mom's mom, and there was one of those old Apple computers, one of those really clunky big things, you know? And the computer was repeating a line over and over. It's kind of the line was certain unknown forces may be listening. A very paranoid 14-year-old. But that was even before the internet, so I don't know, you know. And this voice, as it would say it, would get, every time it would say the line, it would get slower. The voice would slow down. No, did it start off slowed down and then it sped up until it became a normal voice? Yeah, I think it did, because then at first I couldn't tell what it was saying. It was so slow.
Hmm.
Anyway, the camera, as it's saying this, the camera is going down the hallway toward a room, and then and it's me like fighting to wake up. You know?
It's really outside.
Yeah, struggling to wake myself up and get out of that dream.
So, and that's what you're actually doing.
Yeah.
Was it your bedroom in the movie dream?
The room I'm heading toward?
Yeah.
No, it's it was my grandma's room.
Right. And that's not a room that you slept in, presumably, ever.
No.
Does it have associations, that room?
No, except that I always remember like going over to, well, I'll tell you one thing, that house has associations for me because growing up, I sort of had like a, I had a good grandma, and it seems terrible to speak ill of the dead, but I had a bad grandma because it was almost like, I remember thinking of it as a child, like the good witch of, you know, the good witch.
Mm-hmm.
A wicked witch, because the bad grandma was just always just unhappy and very, just my early memories of her, like listening to her like yell at my grandpa, you know? And their house was always very dark.
And whose mother was the bad grandmother then?
I think you could guess.
Father's?
What's that?
Father's.
No, my mom's mom. The one who, she was waiting for her to die before she could.
Gotcha, yeah.
Before she could leave dad. So I always thought, and I always remember thinking that it was weird that they slept in separate bedrooms, that grandpa and grandma had separate bedrooms, you know.
All right, so this is an example of two parents who stayed together no matter what, that imprinted your mother with this, the same idea. Right. This does seem familiar now. It feels like you've talked about it before. So in that dream with the tracking shot, Were you not in the dream then until you were in the scene, in the bed?
Well, I assume I was the camera. I mean, I don't have any sense that I was ever a body, you know. There was no me in it.
Yeah, right. So you were the point of view that was tracking.
I was the.
Yeah, so not really a camera. I mean, that's a bit of a chicken or an egg thing, like, do dreams imitate movies, or do movies imitate dreams? Well, dreams were around a lot longer than movies. And if I have, I mean, the closest I get to a tracking shot in a dream would probably be just that, when I'm disembodied, when I think I've come out of my body and I'm moving around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's like I was telling you and Kelvin, like, I've started having these experiences. It's gone on for the last few years, but I'll be laying in bed waiting to go to sleep, and I'll suddenly see some space that used to be part of my daily life, you know, maybe a certain hallway at school or a apartment that I lived in or something. But the point of view is always from a slightly raised, as if I was hovering above where my body would normally be, you know? And that, so I'll just get these flashes of these images, but it's, you know, it's a different thing than, you know, being a person in a dream or being a, you know, being aware of having a body, you know, and...
Just wondering if it, how the two subjects connect together, if they do, like the sleep paralysis and out of the body. And why did you bring this up to begin with again?
Oh, I just thought that the dream was the voice was really literalizing that fear of the internet, you know?
Fear of the internet, right. Because the internet, as you could say, is a collective disembodiment project. I was just thinking this again. I mean, I've been formulating this thesis for a while now, which is that we're being engineered, our disembodiment is being engineered, and we're engineering it, would be more accurate, I suppose. because I just read this book called The Big Picture. I think it's called The Fighting for the Future of Movies. It's just come out, so they had it at the library. And it's about, you know, what's happened with movies now and how movies and TV have switched places in more ways than one. So, TV now is providing epic movies like True Detective or whatever. Because with binge watching, you even can watch it all in one, obviously not Breaking Bad. But anyway, just even with something like Breaking Bad, the idea is it's kind of like an epic movie, mm-hmm. not just this endless serial like Cheers or something that goes on indefinitely until people lose interest. So while movies are becoming more and more like TV, like the latest Marvel movie is not really a sequel so much as the latest episode. Mm-hmm. And they're even... Anyway, the reason I brought it up was because not just Marvel, it's almost all Disney now, because, you know, Disney owns Marvel, Pixar, and Lucasfilm. So all the Star Wars films, there's one a year now. The Marvel films, at least one a year. The Pixar, mm-hmm. they're all coming out of Disney. It's incredible. It was like the evil empire. You know, it's mm-hmm. going into visible form or something. Of course it would be Disney, right? So these franchises, the new element to them, besides that they could, well, this is how they can do them every year now rather than sequels which take longer, is the cinematic universe. Mm-hmm. So, and they took that out from comics, really. Although even Tarantino played with this. Is interesting to see him as a bit of a forerunner. Like Tarantino, you know, would do a movie with the same characters as the previous movie, but it wasn't a sequel, or the brother of a character. I think there was a brother of the Michael Madsen character in Reservoir Dogs was in Pulp Fiction, I think. Wasn't it Vince Vega was the brother?
Yeah, they had the same last name. It was never discussed, right? It was never.
He did, yeah.
Oh, he did. That was like part of his off-screen mythologizing of.
Yeah. So, but he probably got that from comic books too. I grew up with that. I grew up when it became really overt with the Secret Wars, the Marvel Secret Wars, and then you would have crossovers, Spider-Man. And the Fantastic Four and the Hulk and whatever, the Avengers, for the latest installment of the Secret Wars, you'd go to whichever series, right? I was reading them all anyway, so it wasn't a problem. But still, there might be a slight problem with which one to read first. You have to, you know, it would make it pretty easy. It would tell you which, you know, where it came in the sequence, but still, you can see it kind of takes it to a different level where you do feel this kind of, you know, simulated reality feeling of this is more than just not, it can't be contained by one comic book or one movie. Mm. I think it's exciting to people because it has this feeling that the movie is spilling over the edges of the movie itself into other movies and thereby potentially into life itself. And, I think that that's one of the elements, one of the key elements in luring us into, you know, disembodiment, into the transhumanist downloading of consciousness, whether it's through video games or implants or Netflix binging, or, you know, they're all kind of different ways of.
So there's like a whole alternate universe that is totally immersive that you can escape into.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah, I was thinking that too with Wes Anderson, who I hate. Whenever I talk to his fans, the first thing they always say about why they like him is that the world of Wes Anderson is always the same from film to film, meaning there's always going to be a quirky upper class eccentric wearing a bow tie or, you know, like these kinds of things. And I think that is part of the a lot of the auteurs do kind of offer that, you know, David Lynch has his own world, you know, you always know you're going to get to escape into that fully immersive, different reality.
Except it's David Lynch, so here we could possibly get pulled off track here, but that was what I was referring to as that feeling of betrayal for me of Wild at Heart, was I was expecting to enter into Blue Velvet Lynch, and it wasn't, but anyway, that could be a sidetrack. I don't want to get pulled off by that. But I mean, to bring it back to the Marvel thing, maybe referring to this, the one of the things that was interesting reading about this is that this is very central, that part of this evolution of movies is that Hollywood and the studios, they're morphing into these internet corporations like Amazon and Netflix, and they're a totally different platform. And as an example that I'm going to use, if I write about it, is that Walmart, they, for example, back in the 2000s, Walmart would buy DVDs and sell them at a loss just to get people into Walmart. Uh-huh. So this meant, you know, people would buy the DVDs rather than rent them, number one. They'd actually possess them because they were so cheap. Number two, they'd go into Walmart and they'd buy other stuff. Number three, often they didn't even watch the DVDs. Uh-huh. They just kind of buy them just in case maybe they'd want to watch them. So, so that, you can see how that's a sort of whole cult MO, right? How to lure people into the locus where the fictions are being created and the products are being sold. And this is now extending to the whole of Hollywood now at a more soft level, less literally, because corporations like Amazon and Netflix, they make movies as bait to get people to come onto the sites and sign up. So the movies they make don't have to make money.
Right.
They just have to be good. So weirdly, Amazon is now the prime force in maintaining the art independent cinema at this point, because they've Bozos and co have decided to invest in art cinema. So Ted Hope, you know, the indie guy, he now works for Amazon. Mm. They don't give a shit about movies, let alone art movies. All they care about is the hooks that will reel people into their multinational, you know, virtual realm.
Oh, that's interesting. Yes, because it's like, because they can't possibly lose money, there's sort of no amount of flirty fishing that isn't worth it, you know, isn't part of the...
Well, they could lose money if people lose interest in them as a locus, right?
As a bigger thing, yeah.
And that's, yeah, I mean, they'd have to really fuck up to do that. But one of the ways they'd fuck up is by not expanding the content. And this is, keeping it edgy. And this is actually also a microcosm for what I've been trying to map about culture itself and why it seems as though culture will incorporate subversive artists into it. So you've got Hollywood in the 70s. What happened there? How did that happen? All these really interesting artists were suddenly allowed to make their own movies. Well, it didn't last long, did it? And so what was the effect? It wasn't to revolutionize movies. It was to inject a new, you know, new energy into the dying industry.
Yeah.
So then you got Star Wars, Exorcist, Star Wars, Jaws, and so on. And then, you know, within less than a decade, all of that subversive stuff was flushed out. Nobody could do it anymore. And the industry had revitalized itself, right?
Right. Yeah.
So then that's what these mega corporations are doing now. They don't care about the content, but also they don't care if it's subversive, because it's not going to, it's like a, you know, a mosquito on an elephant's ass kind of thing. It's not really going to change the direction of the monoculture. Mm-hmm. If you just give these people, you know, a little bit of what they want, and thereby lure them into trusting the corporations that are providing it, so right, they'll be imbibing all the rest of the,
yeah,
the toxic stuff.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah, that's a good point.
So yeah, and so, but the overarching thing seems to be, yeah, what content do we need to be lured into I want to kind of phrase it so there's an us but there isn't a them, to be lured into the architecture of illusion mm-hmm. that is being assembled that will allow us to completely forget that we exist as organic beings. And just immerse ourselves, you know, eternally in an infantile or an adolescent fantasy of superpowers and, you know, epic.
Sure. That's the big movie. Then that's the big message of the big movie.
Every morning, missing.
I'm thinking too, wouldn't part of that agenda also, it would have to be this trend that we see more and more of, where the actor who has died is resurrected via computer-generated imagery. And, like, doesn't it feel like, I mean, like, I think Scorsese's making a Netflix movie now,
yeah,
where this digitally de-aged
De Niro and Pacino, yeah.
Right. So they're gonna be young men in this film, and so that's another transcendence of biology, right? Another kind of, I guess, subtle and not so subtle way of kind of sending that message. I feel like people have been very, like, I noticed with Star Wars, people were very turned off by Peter Cushing being resurrected, and it seemed to have a real negative reaction. You can tell that, like, Carrie Fisher is somebody who's very personal to Star Wars fans, and you can almost feel that there's going to be a very big split in as far as how that's accepted, because I'm sure they're bringing her back, right, in this next one.
I didn't know about Peter Cushing. You have to, they just resurrected him digitally, did they?
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God. They're probably sucking in, you know, the hungry ghost that's Peter Cushing floating in the stratosphere, getting sucked in. No.
Well, wouldn't it be, it's only a matter of time before an actor would sign away the rights to their, you know,
eternal soul.
Yeah, you get scanned. Exactly. Scan my soul, it's yours. I don't know what the going rate for that would be.
I know. Well, it's we could get into esoteric here and, you know, speculate on how real that might contract might actually be, but let's not. Yeah. Let's just stay with the facts for now. What was the Peter Cushing story? Which movie was it?
I believe the last Star Wars, wasn't it? His character returns.
I actually watched the last one. That was the Jedi, the new whatever, the last Jedi. I did eventually watch that on an afternoon, but I don't remember any Cushings in it.
Was it the one before that? Did you see the one before it? Maybe I'm talking out of my ass. I mean, I've been boycotting Star Wars since 1984, so.
Well, maybe it's the one to come. Right. So, well, anyway, so let's not get stuck on the details. So, but you're saying that fans might have balked at that. So point being what? That they've got to be quite strategic or systematic in terms of how quickly they introduce these new...
Well, I just don't know if we're there yet. I mean, I've seen examples of this digital de-aging thing where...
I saw a very good one. It was Downey Jr. in one of the Iron Mans.
That's what I was thinking, yeah. And people were very impressed with that. That didn't ruffle any feathers. Of course, it's quite different than somebody who's died, but it'll be interesting to see how the Scorsese film, you know. I mean, I imagine if they have enough money, it won't be. You know, it's back to the uncanny valley, because it's when it looks weird that people are going to have a problem with it, you know.
Unless it was an ethical problem over Peter Cushing's resurrection, but that's hard to imagine from, you know, from Star Wars fans. Although, yeah, I guess I could imagine it with Carrie Fisher. Not exactly to be ethical, but aesthetical, I guess. Mm. You know, as in, that's not the real Carrie Fisher, and you can't tell me it is.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I felt like when I watched that last Blade Runner movie, mm-hmm. and had... I'm blanking on Sean Young's
career. Oh, yeah. But that was really bad, wasn't it?
It was very bad, and it was... I felt that they were... It was almost like an injected sort of dose of nostalgia just to sort of... And there is quite a thing now of... a kind of nostalgia industry, you know, because, you know, we're a whole generation of people who never really grew up, but now are growing old, you know. So we love regurgitating our childhood. But, you know, even the Sean Young presence, that scene doesn't seem to make any sense, except that it's because it's almost like a little test for Harrison Ford to, you know, it's almost like a Turing test, right? That scene, because it's like he recognizes it as a fraud right away and not, you know, whatever love connection he had with her. Not there, and which is very similar to, I feel like, what the audience is feeling in that moment—a kind of repulsion, you know, revulsion.
Yeah. So then, you think it was deliberately bad? The simulation was deliberately unconvincing,
or distasteful. I felt like they must have known that it was going to be distasteful, then, no matter how they, you know, presented it. Right.
I don't know. I mean, the Robert Downey thing wasn't. I mean, the difference with the Iron Man Robert Downey was that it was a simulation within a movie. They weren't actually pretending it was a real flashback. They were showing the technology within the movie, weren't they?
Right, right.
We have this technology now.
Right.
To do with Tony Stark, I don't know. But so that's interesting, because that would create a... That would be a buffer to the uncanny valley, because you're expecting to see a simulation and then you're pleasantly surprised that it looks real. Mm. As compared to in Blade Runner, they're presenting it as it's real and you're seeing what's obviously a simulation.
But are they presenting it as it's real? Maybe I'm not remembering it right, but the whole thing is...
It was a trick, wasn't it? Weren't they trying to trick him?
Yeah, okay, right.
I think so. But anyway, I remember it being definitely worse than the Downey one. Like, she looked too fat and they hadn't got it quite right.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So, but it's the same time as the, you know, they have the same technology that they had for Iron Man. So why would they fudge it? Why would it get fudged? I mean, it's impossible to do more than speculate and pointless to speculate here, but in terms of the sort of the higher, deeper levels of this, how they're acclimatizing us to a disembodied state, mm-hmm. If there is such a thing, I don't know, but at least to, well, they're acclimatizing us to technology anyway, let's put it that way. And then there's these ideas that the technology is both selling to us and kind of riding on, as in, you know, if we believe in a certain idea and the technology will help us get it, then we'll support the technology.
Yeah.
Right?
It'll fuel that quest.
Right. But it's a mutually reinforcing kind of thing, because also if you believe in the technology, then you'll start to believe in the idea. And if the technology is good enough, you'll start to experience the idea and then you'll start to want it and so on. But anyway, this wasn't my point. There's a getting acclimatized to that. I think part of it is the uncanny valley effect, isn't it? Or maybe it is that sort of extended to everything, as in, can we gradually be persuaded to accept what we know isn't real,
right?
And suspend our disbelief and our disgust. You know, when confronted with something that we know isn't real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
And the like the lure is, of course, that reality is so bad that even a counterfeit, even a poor counterfeit's better if it offers what we want, if it offers an escape. From
any escape will do. I mean, it could get so bad that what do you got? I'll take it, you know?
Yeah, so, but this is, I mean, to bring it to the really personal and direct, like, this is a lived experience for me, because I look forward to watching, you know, the next True Detective season or whatever. Little Drummer Girl is downloaded on my hard drive now to watch that series. In a way that's really disproportionate, A, with the quality of enjoyment that I'll have when I watch it, because usually I'm disappointed to some degree or another, and B, with the reality that I'm trying to escape from. I mean, actually, there's nothing wrong with my existence right now that I want to escape from it. Mm. So the lure is, well, I guess this is to do with, maybe it's related to the acclimatization, because we want to get people addicted and then you acclimatize them to, it's like drugs, isn't it? And once you get them on the weed, and then eventually they'll go on to the harder stuff and so on, because they'll need more and more to actually feel what they're, or to shut out the feelings that we're trying not to feel. What was I going to say? Addiction, acclimatization. I mean, I think essentially for myself, I'm trying to recapture the feeling that I once got out of movies and TV shows. Like, I'm still trying to recapture it, really.
Right, which is exactly what the kind of nostalgia culture. I had a friend tell me that when he watches the old Star Wars movies, he doesn't have the same feeling that he had when he was a kid, but actually when he watches the new Star Wars movies, he does have that same feeling. So, I mean, that's a very, that's more literal than what you're talking about, but, we're trying to recapture that first high. Sure.
Yeah. I mean, that is something uncanny, to use that word again, about that Star Wars is still going stronger than ever, and that Marvel movies, obviously going stronger than ever, because this is a new thing, really, but they're bigger. Marvel movies are bigger than Marvel comics ever have been in terms of numbers.
Sure.
Big in China, big everywhere. And that they are both, addicting or enchanting, beguiling, whatever, a whole new generation of kids, and semi-satisfying a much older generation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who grew up on that stuff, roughly the same period. Like, I grew up on Marvel Comics and Star Wars. They're equally comics are more influential by far, actually, but it was a similar period anyway, from about 7 to adolescence, that mm-hmm. coincides with both. Of course, Marvel Comics have been around a long time, but whatever. I mean, I can't even say about the peaks or anything like that, but, and they appeal to similar things. To bring it maybe into slightly into the real here, I was listening to there's this group called they're called Sikhs, I think, Sikhs, and it's like Science Institute. I don't know what that stands for, but they advise Hollywood on science. And I was listening to it through this clandestine spy culture podcast. And their job isn't really to help Hollywood, and it's particularly about Marvel movies here, get science right, but to make it credible. So they're not there to say, well, wait a minute, Tony Stark's costume couldn't really fly or do this and that and the other, unless they'll just say, okay, this is the kind of backstory and the kind of other technology you need to have in the Marvel universe to make that credible.
Right.
And anyway, this woman from this team, if it's a team, was giving a lecture, if you can call it that. And what she was talking about was superpowers. And she was saying that, you know, 1% of you in this room are superheroes and you don't know it yet. And she was talking about innate superpowers, as in people who can breathe at high altitudes, people who don't need to sleep much and so on, right? But then she went on to how, you know, we're developing the technology now to engineer your superpower. And pretty soon it's going to be an ethical question, how young should kids be before they're allowed to choose their superpower?
Right, of course. That's just real quick, that reminds me too of the main thrust of Temple Grandin's whole thing, you know, is that there's an autistic superhero in the bunch and we've got to find them and encourage their superpowers.
Well, interestingly, this, I think it was the same woman, it was on the same podcast anyway, was saying that the superheroes of the future won't be Aspergerans. They won't be socially retarded. They won't be this, that, and the other. They won't forget to brush the back of their hair. As in, she gave a sort of anti-autist little speech in the middle of the rest of it to say, you know, forget about those losers. Now it'll be the jocks and the cheerleaders, you know, who will be the superheroes, because they were like a failed, you know, what do you call that? Like a failed prototype kind of thing, early model that's being discontinued.
Huh. Okay. Did she offer ample evidence of that trend, or?
She didn't seem like somebody to be hampered by things like evidence.
Okay. Well, that's helpful for her.
But it occurred to me that if this does relate to trauma genesis, because of course she wasn't talking about MK Ultra when she was talking about engineering superpowers, she was talking about chromosomes and this, that, and the other. But you could even make an argument that that's kind of a trauma, you know, biological trauma. But anyway, if it does relate to trauma genesis, i.e., you know, psyche fragging to access psychic potential, then maybe the you know, the precogs or the early autists, you know, were like these prototypes of trauma genesis that were, you know, malfunctioning. Mm-hmm. And now they're ironing out the wrinkles.
Perfect. Oh, I see. Okay. Well, I've certainly thought of autistics as the kind of midwives for AI, for bringing AI into existence, but I hadn't thought about it quite like that.
Yeah. Well, not unrelated.
Yeah, right. This might be a good time to bring this William Burroughs quote that I found into, since we're talking about drugs and disembodiment and technology. I found that, because we were talking about him in the context, you were talking about him in the sense of you connected him to the Peeping Tom.
Catharsis, yeah.
Failed catharsis, right?
Right.
Okay, well, that's interesting. We'll come back to that because it fits in here. Here he's talking about the human body. And I've always been aware that, you know, the Timothy Learys and Robert Anton Wilson, didn't he actually have his daughter's brain frozen?
He did, yeah. I was shocked when it was the first Wilson book I read, and I was shocked by that.
Yeah.
At the time, even.
And Leary did as well, his own brain, right? Supposedly, maybe.
I don't know, yeah. I didn't remember that if I'd heard it.
So these early psychedelic guys or drug people, and I didn't know that Burroughs was as into it, but I just find this quote, here he's talking about the human body. Here we have an artifact weighing about 170 pounds that cannot exist outside of a very specialized environment, sort of an aqua lung. And the official space programs, how do they propose to solve this? They are going to move this whole artifact, the human artifact, in its environment from one place to another. It would not occur to them to start from the other end. Now you have an object, X, that is the human body, and you want to transport X from, say, Earth to space, from E to S, and X is heavy and can only live in a whole medium. So why not alter X to reduce its weight and its dependency on its medium? That would seem a logical approach to the problem. Now, this would not occur to the official programs because they accept the human artifact with all its limitations. You'll love this. In effect, they accept the limitations imposed by Christianity, by what Crowley calls the slave gods.
Wow.
Now the human body is much too dense for space conditions. We have a model to hand, and that is less dense, in fact almost weightless, and that would be the astral or dream body. And I postulate that the function of dreams may be to prepare us for space. And that is why they are a biological necessity.
You just summoned the discarnate spirit of Burroughs there.
And Terence McKenna, too, he would constantly talk about the Earth being a kind of womb. This fits in really well with your Big Mother theory, because it would be like, he would always talk about the Earth as a kind of womb, and if we don't leave it, we're going to kill Mother and us, you know? It's like,
Wow, so he was advocating space travel too, then?
Yeah.
Do you know if he was advocating in a literal physical sense, or?
Or psychedelic astral travel?
Yeah, or more I
think he was down for both.
I once had a dream that I was walking down the street, didn't quite feel myself, and I looked over to see my reflection in a shop window, and I was William Burroughs.
Was there more to the dream? What was your reaction?
I don't think I had a strong reaction. A strong ab reaction, or either way, I was like, oh. But it certainly stayed with me.
Yeah. Well, what do you make of the, it's like you're always talking about mother enmeshment. It's like, here you have scientists, well, I guess we can't even say, I mean, maybe we could say Elon Musk or any of these people who are pushing for Mars. So, funny that the red planet, the war, the god of war,
masculine sexuality as well.
Yeah, right. And it's like this kind of literal way to break free of the mother, but also recreate another mother via technology.
Well, I don't know if they're still talking about this, but it used to be that in order to get to Mars, they had to create a base on the moon or a push-off point on the moon and move tech there, and then...
Because
the moon is kind of like the...
feminine.
The bad mother. You got the Earth is the good mother, and the moon is the bad grandmother, even. Anyway, you were halfway asking a question, I think.
Yeah, I don't know, but I just wanted to get your first of all, you must have a reaction to this Burroughs Crowley stuff and the McKenna enmeshment stuff.
Yeah, well, it surprised me and not surprised me at the same time. It surprised me it's so on point. Like, if I wanted something to, finalize my distrust of Burroughs, where you just provided it.
There it is in writing.
But on the other hand, it also, doesn't it kind of, it validates the narrative in the sense not of it being having value, but in the sense that it really is like a narrative that isn't dependent on individual proponents. If you see what I mean, like it goes so deep into our culture. If you find all these different disparate cultural influences who've been propagating same or similar ideas for the last 100 years, I guess we're talking now, at least. But if we start go back to Crowley anyway, more than 100 years. And a lot of it you can actually trace to Crowley and just his influence, but not all of it by any means. So I don't know. I mean, I have I feel as though I'm going to say a psyop that's effective has to tap into a very deep level of archetypal yearning, and then back to Marvel superheroes, isn't it? And Star Wars, and create a facsimile of what will actually answer that yearning. As in, I say, if we have a yearning, it's true. Like a yearning comes from a sense that something isn't present that we want present, or that something, we're not in touch with something that we need to be in touch with. So the yearning is true, and thereby that means that what we're yearning for is true too, but we don't have the capacities to formulate or conceptualize it. And actually, by definition, I'd say it's beyond conceptualization. We just have to encounter it somehow. But the human mind is such that it strives to conceptualize what it's trying to get to, as if that was like it wants to build the map and then follow the map to reach the treasure, that whole thing in us. So then it's like, I feel as though people like Burroughs and Crowley, they were in touch with the yearning, and they were so driven by it that they developed a deep intuitive understanding of the reality they were yearning for, and then they created a counterfeit of it. Mm-hmm. Maybe for themselves, even. I suppose this is what Prisoner Infinity is about, isn't it? And part of the counterfeit was, or central to the counterfeit, was that they would sell it to other people. Like if you create a counterfeit unconsciously, or consciously really, the way to validate it is to make other people use it, and it becomes a real currency. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I mean, my feeling with someone like Burroughs is, I don't feel, or McKenna for that matter, even possibly Crowley, I don't feel like he was sitting there thinking, how can I deceive the masses? You know, I think it really was grappling with a genuine sense of disconnection and trying to solve it. Mm-hmm. And then got lured into, I guess this is in this latest piece I'm writing about, which one of the premises I come up with, or more of a premise than a conclusion, which is that if individuals and groups are engineering society and history, then it depends on two things. One, that they're possessed by something that transcends them, and the other, that they can possess others. So then it's not, the mistake we make is that it's about human groups and human agencies manipulating events and individuals. It's not, it's like a collective possession that gets passed on. Mm-hmm. And the way to pass it on is to let yourself be possessed by it. If you let yourself be possessed by it, you get, you know, power is given unto you. It's like Jesus' gesture in the desert. Mm. Yes, the third temptation. The power is given unto you, the power of charisma and whatnot, and then you can possess others. Mm-hmm. And then you realize the dream, sort of. Well, yeah, you do, but it's a nightmare because, right, it was just a dream.
Because you're part of a lineage of vampires?
Well, yeah.
sweet on earth will stumble as it starts, almost fall apart, tumbling towards a birth, like the baby nightingale that falls out of the sky. Still she has to try or fail before she starts. Love is there inside your eyes, please take a look, for your eyes describe this better than any book. Love is morning even in the night. Hey, here comes the light. The marigolds are off the hook, the arrow is in flame. Purple, what's your name? Someday I'll look you up. We only trip through happiness and never quite arrive. Will you take this life? We always answer yes. Love is there inside your eyes, just to take. For your eyes describe this better than any book. Love is morning even in the night. Hey, here comes the light.
It's funny you should say that, because that came out in a off the record conversation I had recently about the lineage of vampires.
Tell me about that.
Well, have you and I talked about it at all?
About vampires?
Yeah.
No. I don't think so.
Mm. Well, now it's a bit Twilight Zone-y then, because it feels as though you were eavesdropping on conversations.
Are we back to all is one and one is all?
Or back to the paranoia of
certain unknown forces.
Yeah, constant surveillance. Yeah. Well, because I put non-humans on a list of, you know, on a conspiracy spectrum at the very end, as in at the furthest end to the end that's historically verifiable conspiracy, and the furthest end of non-verifiable, but can we actually dismiss it as non-human?
Okay.
Right. And what I was wondering just yesterday anyway about this was, how do we know that we're not being led to believe in these things, because then we project that onto ordinary human forces.
So you're talking about that extreme pull where you're acknowledging like a supernatural possibility of, say, reptilians or mind parasites or whatever. You're saying that if we're being led to accept that, then that, and then we project that onto,
yeah,
yeah, that could be part of some
well, yeah, how do we know? I mean, see, the answer I gave myself was, well, I feel like I do know that, you know, paranormal stuff happens. Like, I've had too many experiences to think that everything is just the way it seems. But on the other hand, my analysis of social engineering and psychological operations, such as it is, I mean, the extent of the research I've done, convinces me that those agendas go very deep, and they're very elaborate, and they're very far-reaching, and they really are working very hard to generate myths that then and beliefs that then generate their own evidence.
I see. Yeah. Right.
Have you read Castaneda?
No.
So that's one of my go-tos that I don't go to anymore, because I don't trust Castaneda, because he's one of those guys now. But the books themselves remain what they always were. They haven't changed just because I've changed my view of Castaneda. I just would have to read them with a much more suspicious eye. And maybe if I did reread them now, it would change my viewpoint of the material in them as well as Castaneda. But I read them many, many times. And not counting Art of Dreaming, I never really saw any cracks in them. They always felt real to me, but then I just felt that way about Strieber too, not to the same degree, however. And one of the things in Castaneda is about these old seers who have learned to extend their lifespans through sorcery, and how their bid is to dominate everyone and everything on the planet. And it's kind of just a side point in Castaneda. He doesn't go into it in any depth. But it always stayed with me. And so, unlike David Icke's reptilians, say, that has become, like, I took that one on as, you know, part of my interpretation of the world.
Because maybe you felt more evidence or presence of that.
Well, it felt more credible, his account, some in the context, everything just felt real. And then again, chicken or an egg thing. And then, you know, I had experiences, dream, generally dreams, but dream-like experiences that seemed to confirm that perspective. And, you know, who knows? It's like, how do we end up believing anything?
Right.
Particularly things that there's no physical basis for.
But you seem to be saying that despite all the, you know, betrayals by these hero figures that you've had in your youth, that for some reason this particular idea, you've kept it on board. It seems to have some sort of intuitive value for you.
Well, because it doesn't depend on Castaneda. Like, let's say, well, they're all seers and they do this, that, and the other. And the idea that there are entities who aren't human as we think of as human, who have involvement in our affairs, obviously that's consistent to all kinds of mythologies, including Christianity, although there would just be demons there. There wouldn't necessarily be a human type, you know, element. Go ahead.
I was using the word vampires in a really metaphorical sense, but, you know, we have to be careful, right, about how we use metaphors, right? Because,
Well, what would it be a metaphor for, then?
I couldn't even say that, you know. I mean, you know, like with the reptilians, it's like, it's just so literal, because the psychotic drives of the reptilian brain, you know, are how people get ahead in the world, you know, not caring about others. And so, you know, you could say that, you know, a metaphor for forced forces within us that like to feed off of, you know, others, a sociopathic kind of...
Mm-hmm. And that live on, that transcend death.
Yeah, I guess right.
So, I mean, one thing we know for is real is our ancestors, that they existed. Like, we know that we didn't just pop out here out of nowhere. We came at the end of the latest, you know, iteration of a very long multi-dimensional centipede or millipede of other human lives. And then the notion that somehow our ancestors are still present.
Yeah.
Now that, of course, is more speculative, and someone like Sam Harris would scoff at it. But I'm not really interested in what Sam Harris thinks anyway, I suppose.
But even there with Sam Harris, you can say, well, the reptilian brain does exist. You can point to it on a map of the brain, and this is the ancestor brain, you know?
Yeah, the distant ancestor, yeah. And point to the genes and say, yeah, the characteristics and traits that our ancestors developed, and even their circumstances have, through epigenetics, have passed on to us, and we're now carrying them around. So yes, for sure, but how far you're willing to go with that literal physical fact and extrapolate an equally literal but less physical reality, as opposed to just to keep it metaphorical. Mm-hmm. I would say that you wouldn't get very far with Sam Harris, but you might get further with someone like Donald Cowshed, obviously Jung, but Jung's a bit iffy. As in somebody who's really gone into deep psychological explorations and seen that the way that the psyche manifests can be very mysterious and even seem to have physical dimensions to it in terms of stigmata and whatnot. Well, that's one thing. It's an amazingly difficult subject to talk about, I suppose. I think it's because the dangers you go up a level from just pure physical, and you bring the same criteria to upper level, then the dangers you will physicalize and literalize something in a way that will that isn't necessary. So I know that this is could be a cop out, and it's quite a common idea now in the new age circles, but that vampires and reptilians and things may actually have the power to make them more literal and more real than they are, and less, you know, that you know, our choice about what we believe about them may actually influence the way that we experience them. In fact, I think that's undeniable.
Well, let me ask you this, because, you know, earlier you were kind of talking about protecting against possession. Do you think it's necessary to believe in possession for possession to occur? Do you feel like you have to believe that that's real before you know, you can be possessed by ancestors or any?
No, certainly not. In fact, I'd say that would be the thing that would make one most vulnerable, if one completely was ignorant of it, dismissed it.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So it sounds like you're saying, though, that by believing in it, or that there has to be a careful way of looking at that without allowing it to manifest as a physical reality and influence our lives.
Well, I think it's more about getting fixated on it, isn't it? Like if we were to talk about vampires or old seers or reptilians, we could very quickly get into a way of talking that was very, you know, what's the word? Titillating, scary, you know, fascinating, just fascinating. We could speculate and we could and make it coherent and end up convincing ourselves that we're really talking about something we know something about.
Yeah, and turn it into a best-selling script, right?
Well, I did write a book once called Answer to Lucifer. It was about the reality of vampires, and I laid it all out, why they're real, how they're real, how I know they're real.
The whole thing. So you're speaking from experience. You really went deep into it.
I did, and I ended up... Wait, was it before? Was this before or after that I got hookworm? It was after this. No. It was during, because it took a long time on that book, but it was during the same period I got hookworm, which are physical vampires.
Oh.
Really fucked me up, I tell you. I mean, the medicine for hookworm really fucked me up because they're really hard to get rid of. So yeah, maybe that's a perfect example. I mean, I opened my psyche to something in a way that was naive or irresponsible or whatever, and I paid the consequences, suffered the consequences. And the fact is that during that period, I was fascinated by vampires during a long period here, several years. And I believe that I was one of them in a past life. I mean, we take it with a pinch of salt. Like, I never believed, and I've never really believed anything 100%. Well, about anything, but these kinds of things. It's like trying them on for size. But this one really did seem to fit, like so many of them. And yeah, it became definitely an object of fascination for me.
I'm interested in this idea in your blog series recently. I was reading in the comments, there was quite a debate over how much meaning should we assign to, you know, tragic events that happen in our lives that seem to be senseless and seem to be accidents. Do you know that thread that I'm kind of...
Yeah.
There seemed to be quite a polar... You know, as you put it, on one hand, shit happens, and then on the other hand, you know, everything has some kind of meaning. It's either all, how did you put it? It's either all meaningful
or it's all meaningless. Yeah, and therefore, yeah, it has to be meaningful. But at the other end of the spectrum to shit happens was karma, I'd say, where somebody has a system of meaning and it's already worked out. Because that's, you don't necessarily, to allow that everything's meaningful, you don't have to pretend that you know what everything means. Like, that's a leap.
Right, of course not. Right. Yeah, there would be rigid symbols of, you know, a kind of self-serving numerology that you're overlaying on your daily life. But I thought of it because I had this experience with a friend who was very much like a pretty hardcore materialist, rationalist, atheist, you know, what you see is what you get kind of. I mean, I've always been kind of interested by these people because a lot of them that I've known, While they claim to be atheists, are also seem to be like sort of amused by occult imagery, you know? Like, it has some sort of kitsch value for them that you can never quite understand what that stuff really represents for them, other than it seems to be fun for them. But anyway, we were making this movie that fell apart. It really fell apart. But we would go on these road trips to do filming, and he had this very like tumultuous relationship with a girlfriend that was like a constant source of, you know, it was like it was a bad relationship. They were always fighting, you know. And whenever we would go on these road trips, on the way down on the road, at first, you know, he would be so excited because it was like his escape from the home life, you know, escape from the wife. And he would just be in the best mood. And then by the end of the trip on the way up, you would just see it like, you know, just a deep depression as he would get closer and closer to home, you know, like his vacation was over and he was, you know, dreading the next fight or whatever. Anyway, we had this experience where he was driving, I was in the passenger seat, we were on the highway, and he had this album that he was playing on repeat a lot that had a female singer. he said to me, he was like listening to her voice, and he said, why can't I have a girlfriend like this, like her, you know? And then right at that moment, oh shit, this is probably gonna give away his name. His last name was Hawk. And a hawk, like the bird, a hawk, flew right in front, real slow and real low, flew in front of us. Later he told me that he made eye contact with the hawk right before it hit. Shattered the whole windshield, you know. And you know, there's a little more to the story involving like a phone call to the girlfriend and stuff, but my point is, like, you know, like he shrugged that off like shit happened. Like, to if my name was Hawk and a hawk hit my windshield right after I dissed my girlfriend, you know, I would have to look at that, you know. I would have to examine, you know, what is the universe or the simulation or whatever it is, what is it trying to tell me in this moment, you know? What changes do I need to make about my life here, you know?
So he didn't even talk about it.
No, I was like, I think I tried to get it, you know. I was like, are you even considering? What are you thinking about? Yeah.
He wasn't upset about the Hulk either, I take it.
No, he was very upset. I mean, he was crying, you know. It was, he was crying on the way home. And the other part of the story is that, you know, he texted his girlfriend right after it happened, I just hit a Hulk. And then he went to go try to find the hawk, to find the dead hawk. I remember I picked a feather out of the windshield and kept it. And on the way back, got back on the road, his girlfriend called, and he didn't want to talk to her. So he's like, can you answer it? This is another one of these things where I should just be like, no, I'm not going to answer. It's one of these things where I end up like, you know. And I answered it, and she was like, she was laughing. She was like, who hits a hawk? You know, she thought it was really funny. Like, yeah. So I'm like hearing her laugh, and I'm looking at him cry in the same moment, you know? It was just such a fucking heavy metaphor for that relationship, you know?
Right, because he's the hawk. So we could even see that as a, maybe you already did go this route, as a warning from her to him. Big mother. This is what will happen to you if you try and go off with any, you know, rock star chicks. But do you wonder, or did you, or do you wonder that, like, if he was physically affected by that and then he was crying, then isn't that another way for him to integrate the meaning of that experience without necessarily having to do any ruminating about it mentally?
Like, is the emotional processing of the actual, like the killing of the hawk, is that enough of a, is that what you're saying?
Like, it sounds as, I mean, if he was crying for the hawk and he identified with the hawk, he empathized and thereby identified with the hawk, and that's the central meaning of the event, as you've described it. His name was Hawk, he killed the hawk, right? So he experienced it at an affect level in his body. Mm. And that's where stuff happens anyway, I think. Like, we can, as you're saying about the numerological systems that people have, how to interpret everything that happened, that kind of approach is worse than blowing it off often, I think. You just compartmentalize it. Now I've worked it out. I mean, that made me think of Crowley, or someone like Crowley. Like, nothing could happen in Crowley's life that he wouldn't be able to refer it to his magical system and interpret it and then apply some kind of, you know, countermeasure or maximize the potential, whatever he would do. It was about micromanaging, you know, his relationship to the universe.
Yeah, down to a science, yeah.
Down to a science, right? And there's probably nothing less healthy than that, if Crowley's an example to go by.
Yeah.
And just bring it back to, you know, the context of this was talking about vampires and non-human beings as well. If such things exist, then we would know it. We couldn't not know it. Our bodies would know it. I mean, even specifically speaking, if there's a predatorial species on the planet and we're the prey, we're going to know it.
We would feel that on a very visceral level.
Absolutely, yeah. So then we know it. If it's true, we know it. And if it's not true, we don't know it. Getting the mind involved is definitely problematic. And so how involved does it need to be? A question like this, like, you're talking about possession. Does being ignorant of possession protect? No, but then neither, I'd say, is being informed about possession wouldn't necessarily protect either, because you're likely to be misinformed anyway. I mean, you could be rightly informed, but how would you know that you were? Because who are you going to go to? A Catholic priest, an energy healer, a shaman? So many options there. They'll all give you different versions. But they'll all be, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily all address the mind, but I mean, as far as talking about understanding, that's a mental thing, isn't it? So, I think it's more to do with not making up your mind about things of that kind, which almost kind of means not talking about them, doesn't it? Because if you haven't got a position on it, how do you talk about it? You could just say, well, it could be true. Maybe it's not true. and then just keep circling the houses, really.
Sure.
Now, unless you go to the metaphor, as you were suggesting.
What's that?
Unless you go to the metaphor, as you were suggesting. And then I think it is. I mean, for me, I'd go to the metaphor of ancestral possession and hungry ghosts, and then it would be a little closer to experiential reality. Like, I know I can observe the ways in which I'm possessed by my father and my brother's sexual addiction, to use a really
right
dark example, visceral example.
Yeah, well, when you said that about kind of being in the middle zone of maybe this or maybe that. Those are generally the kind of people I like to hang out with, you know. It's quite similar to Kerry McCoy was kind of describing himself as an agnostic Gnostic, you know. It's I quite like to avoid the poles, you know. You know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's liminality.
Right.
And it's flexibility too.
Mm-hmm.
Like the closer you get to the pole, the stronger the magnetic pull. So even if you're not pulled all the way in, which eventually you will if you keep getting closer, you're still going to have less freedom to move, like the more of a pull you're feeling. So the closer you are to the middle, the less of a pull there is from either side.
Mm.
And then, so then you can move both directions and sort of gauge that field, right? Oh, now I'm getting a bit too close, I'm feeling the pull. Back away. Go the other way. And
yeah, that's a great continuation of that metaphor, huh?
I wrote this piece, I'm going to start blogging on Saturday, about conspiracy spectrum, what's it called? Divide and conquer within conspiracy research. And it's about these poles. And so what I spend a lot of time to begin with describing are the two ends of the spectrum, the conspiracy true believers, the conspiracy debunkers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And one, I sent it out to a few people to early comments. I didn't include you because I knew you already had too much to read anyway. And one of them was saying, well, I'm not really interested in either of those perspectives. I'm interested in what's really going on. But I'm really interested in this. How a spectrum has become a polarity, and how that polarization creates a split, and how I experience it in myself. So I'm choosing to focus on Hollywood, satanic Illuminati mind control in Hollywood, kind of being the extreme conspiracy true believer spectrum, you know, end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum being, they're just movies. Yeah.
Right.
Nothing going on here. What are you talking about? Wouldn't even allow for propaganda, maybe a little bit. And how I've once upon a time I was at one end of the spectrum, and now I'm sort of at the other one, except I do try and stay in the middle in a way. Like I still want to be able to see both sides.
Well, I was thinking about that in your video, the video of our podcast, where the terror as an organizing principle video, where you were talking about that, of just really just to muddy those waters and just to discredit the even idea of conspiracy. I thought you articulated that really well, and it makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, I have to admit myself, like, because I'm writing about it, you kind of encouraged me to explore the shadow narratives of the Sandy Hook thing. I made this effort to, because what I want to do is I want to just present a brief overview of what the speculation of, because the internet is kind of the collective, unconscious, the kind of, you can encounter the shadow on the internet, you know, you can see what our deepest collective fears are, you know. I'm kind of wanting to give an overlay of that, but I mean, I have to say my patience for the conspiracy crowd. And I was thinking about that, I listened to one, and within the first 5 minutes, you know, they're talking about the dollar bill and the pyramid on the dollar bill. For some people, for some reason, people love to fucking fixate on the dollar bill, you know, the occult symbology and that. And, you know, I realize even as I'm talking that I must be alienating your listeners, but
probably not. I mean, maybe if you could talk about mocking crisis actors here or whatever, but anyway, I mean, you can always alienate somebody. But I had in this piece I'm working on, I included fake news articles in air quotes, although I think the genuinely fake news articles about, you know, Brad Pitt says the blood drinking Illuminati this, and Keanu Reeves says they're eating babies in Hollywood. There's kind of, well, I say those kinds, there haven't been that many, but there are at least those two fairly recently, because they interest me, like, where do they come from and what effect are they having? So I included them in the piece, but I really felt myself what you're describing a bit similar. Like I felt such distaste for them and for that material, even though I kind of think it's true. It's very weird. Anyway, so I have to get, you know, how to, what is it, you know? It's gullibility. It's people who are credulous, or of course, in many cases they're deliberately muddying the water. Got to keep that in mind. They might not be sincere at all, but if they are sincere, it's not good.
Yeah. Either way, it's not good.
Well, I guess it's the desire to believe, isn't it? You're talking about something really horrible. I mean, not so much the dollar bill, but the implications of that are pretty awful, really. But certainly the other stuff, something really awful. In a way, you know, it's kind of salacious and titillating, and it's news, and you can bet these people still carry on watching Hollywood movies and carry on living their lives exactly the same way, except they're spending more time at conspiracy sites and less time at mainstream sites, but still more or less the same engagement with media.
Meaning it doesn't like lead to any kind of real world changes or...
Well, yeah. not even that, because they might go and take a gun and shoot up a pizza restaurant or whatever.
right.
I don't believe that really happened, but anyway. You know, or go to Newton and try and expose the crisis actors. They could get proactive, and that could be a bad thing or a good thing, whatever. But, I mean, they might do lots of stuff that changes the internet, if not the world. But it doesn't necessarily really change the quality of their lives.
When I die, I hope you never find another guy. I hope you stay in every night, wishing you were dead. Never smile and never kiss. I hope your heart becomes scientific and beats just cause it needs to. I hope your hands never touch another. Sounds bad.
Right. And I think too, because when you're talking about gullibility, you're also talking about, you know, to bring it back to the personal, it's that all these macro events are corresponding to some kind of personal, you know, so many people are victims of abuse. And so, you know, the conspiracy genre could be seen as a kind of way to try and process somebody's own individual experiences of abuse and pain. It's almost similar to the self-help industry, right, in that the self-help industry is sort of exploiting those vulnerabilities and people's backgrounds, and you can kind of see that with the conspiracy for profit industry, the conspiracy industry, that they're kind of, they know where the triggers are and they're pulling them.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And you can see it in the overlap between, I mean, like you were talking on the previous thing about how the internet's being mined now for popular entertainment, with something like Stranger Things, that, like, we had infotainment already. I mean, the news became a kind of infotainment, and now we're seeing, I suppose it's from the other side of the spectrum, how entertainment is cannibalizing information or quasi-information on the internet, which makes it palatable. And again, it must be a spectrum, because for me, researching conspiracy social engineering has been therapeutic. So I wouldn't want to take that away from anyone else. Mm-hmm. But didn't we touch on this when we were talking about failed catharsis, that I'm not sure now, I can't remember, my brain's getting a bit foggy, but I think, you know, for every one person who really is able to kind of navigate that psychic unconscious that swamp of the collective unconscious via the internet or entertainment or art, self-expression, whatever it is, there's 99 who just drown in it.
That's my feeling. Yeah. And I think your tools for navigating that are probably a little stronger than, I mean, what I do appreciate about you, this almost gets back to who your target audience is. I mean, with your audience, I feel like there's a big chunk of people who are interested in conspiracy who listen to you. Mm-hmm. And I feel like there's also a chunk of people who are interested in spiritual seeking who listen to you. Yeah. And there's a bit of an interesting overlap between those demographics, you know? Yeah. Also, just a quick side note, I think most of your female listeners are on. I think it's mostly dudes.
Conspiracy aside, yeah.
Where was I going with this? What I appreciate about you, because I am interested in conspiracy, but I can't, you know, I really enjoy listening to you talk about it, but I can't listen to the higher side chats, you know?
Me neither.
But I think, you know, like, there is that demographic. And I guess what I'm saying is, what I appreciate about your approach to conspiracy is that, you appreciate rules of evidence, and you're generally, like, analyzing it on a more intelligent level than, I don't know, the guy who's stoned, or,
Yeah, well, I certainly hope so. I think there's two main ways in which that happens. One is, I am interested in the actual consequences, the victims of it, on the one hand. And on the other hand, that I'm interested in how my own personal complicity with it, as well as being one of the victims of it. Actually, that wasn't the second thing I was going to mention, so maybe it's three, but also I'm interested in how it can be used as a way to better understand, I don't want to use a big word here, but psychosocial reality. So the intersection between the psyche and society, and just how human interactions, or what, how the field, the playing field's been unleveled, you know, for human interaction. What's going on? Why are we're not even able to connect and communicate?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
So all those things are quite practical, like real life victims, effects of trauma, my own personal complicity, and like everybody acknowledges that the world's fucked up and that they're not happy. Well, some people don't admit it, I suppose, but more or less everyone acknowledges that now. But they're not really looking at how or why. Even like a conspiracy tards, and the, you know, Trump haters and the neoliberals or whatever we call them, they do the same thing, really. They just point the finger and start yelling.
Mm. I say, so you're saying part of it is accepting your own responsibility, or in the grand scheme of the herd.
Grand scheme of the herd.
Well, you know, in the terms of like how these psychosocial things travel and what your part of it is.
Yeah, I mean, how else can we really map them if not in our own lives? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I know, I mean, I have started actually writing about my own life. Maybe at some point they'll come together, like my conspiracy think pieces and my, you know, personal life stories. Maybe they'll start to intersect and come together like you're doing with Notes in Uncanny Valley. That would be very interesting if that happened. Because, I mean, certainly, obviously, I put autobiographical material in my books about social engineering, but that's, you know, because I'm looking for relevant clues in my past. And that, obviously, that's really central to what I'm saying. But also in the present, like, you know, why do I behave in the ways that I behave? Why do I get stuck in these loops of self, you know, sabotaging behavior and so on? Whatever it is that's causing dissatisfaction, you can't blame the conspiracy, but you can trace a continuum between one's own neurotic patterns or trauma, you know, traumatic conditioning and the shape of the conspiracy social engineering programs.
And you can hope to overcome it, don't want to use the metaphor of reprogramming, but
right.
That's interesting about self-sabotage. Darren Westland and I talk about that quite a bit. Yeah, that is tied into all that, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely is, yeah. Yeah, because it's like all of us know how to live. Well, there's a part in all of us that knows how to live. Like knows how to breathe, knows how to stand, how to walk, how to eat right, how to choose the right partner, how to connect in conversations, unless we're just completely fucked. And I actually have to say there probably are a lot of people who are now, or others, tragically, but even there's some residue. They're not so completely fucked they don't ever experience a moment of, you know, in tune and flow, just being right at harmony with existence, surely. Well, maybe there is, actually. I mean, we seem to be getting to that point. But anyway, most of us do have some sense, still, innate sense of how to be. So then self-sabotage is that's the main thing. Like, if we weren't constantly self-sabotaging ourselves unconsciously, we would just be being the way that God and nature intended us to be. For sure, that's true. It's not like we've got to build a, you know, a tower to Babel or a bridge to infinity, the star child now, but you know, go through that whole Stargate thing to get where we're trying to get. That's absurd. I think it's just we have to stop doing the thing that actually is preventing us from being present. And I don't know of any way to stop doing that besides just looking more closely at how that got installed in me. I mean, that's my way. I don't think it's necessary everybody's, but.
Well, let me ask you this. So I'm going to throw out an idea, and I bet that you can probably tie this in what we're talking about better than I can, but, you know, whenever I'm entertaining the idea of whenever I'm feeling distrustful of, say, cultural figures, maybe that used to be, you know, hero figures or father figures, and I think about the idea of them being, you know, something sinister. Maybe, you know, whether that be like a CIA asset or whatever it is, there's always this voice in the back of my head that says, oh, you're just jealous.
Yeah, I have that voice, too.
Yeah, okay, good. And I mean, that sort of opens up a whole nother thing where, you know, because then you're saying, well, you know, you self-sabotaged your chances at quote-unquote success, and then that opens up a whole question of what is success, and what, you know, that's a whole nother thing, and whether or not that's even something that should be strived for. But then also, then you're like, you know, in a sense, you're sort of, you're blaming the conspiracy instead, you know, for whatever you feel is, whatever injustices you feel are happening in your personal life.
Yeah. There's a lot of layers there, because I mean, I've become more conscious of that recently, that voice, as one that I want to listen to check that I'm not falling prey to confirmation bias. As in, I've already made up my mind that the reason I'm not successful is because the whole system is rigged, and in order to be successful, you have to rape children, you know, on a monthly basis at secret rituals on Bohemian Grove, whatever, not really the Bohemian Grove, but, and not even that whole thing. But anyway, I'm being a bit glib, but you know what I mean? You have to participate, you have to be an insider, and you have to be compromised in such a way that you're allowed to ascend. And or handpicked from the start, and so on and so forth. But I don't actually know there aren't any exceptions to that. Like, that would be absurd. I can say that I've kind of seen enough evidence for that being at play in our society to feel confident that it is. But that doesn't mean there are no exceptions. So, and I don't want to take an absolutist position there, but I find that I do. As in, if anyone's really successful, being heavily promoted, got into, actually for the first time, it wasn't an argument, discussion with my wife about Julian Assange in this thing, because I just, like, I can't believe that Julian Assange is for real, because he was on the cover of Time magazine, you know? But to reiterate, I just don't know there aren't exceptions. And I actually don't think it does quite work that way. I think it is more nuanced and subtle and complex. For example, I think that people are promoted as a way to sabotage them also. Like, if they can't, I shouldn't say they, but one way to neutralize potentially disruptive elements within society is to promote them, even. Mm. That would be a measure, gains, losses, short-term losses for long-term gain. We'll promote this person for a while because we've done a profile on him, we know he's going to end up snorting cocaine off hooker's tits and self-destruct within, 12-18 months. So we'll just let him have a little fun and influence in the meantime, right? Whatever. Mm-hmm. So that's obviously a big nuance there. Anyway, point being is that, I'm more aware of a part of me that does need to believe this, because otherwise I'd still be unresolved about why the fuck aren't I more successful than I am. Like, I have come up with an answer for that satisfied me, but it does depend on this worldview, the Jan Irvin worldview. Mm. Not that he copyrighted it, but he's probably the most well-known proponent of it at this point. In our circles anyway. And so, of course, that makes me distrust it.
It makes you distrust that worldview?
In myself, yeah. Knowing that it reassures me means...
Yeah. There must be something wrong if it's reassuring.
Exactly.
Well, it's funny, just real quick, that it almost feels like the next generation of an earlier worldview, which we got into a little bit when we were talking, when I sent you that D.W. Griffith quote about movies curing the world of violence. And the David Byrne quote that juxtaposes against that. And you were kind of saying how David Byrne at one point went from being edgy to being too cute. And it used to be, the worldview used to be that people who were hugely successful had gotten there through a process of compromise. And that, you might see their artistic integrity early on in their careers before they sold out, right? Mm-hmm. But also just the idea that there are millions and millions of even more uncompromising artists who... never even got to that first stage, right? And they're just totally unknown. Do you see that kind of connection with me? It's just like the now it's not that the big movie star has sold out. It's that the big movie star is, raping children, and it's like an even darker version of
selling their soul.
Selling their soul, yeah. And I was thinking about it too, because, I was thinking about what you said about David Byrne being cutting and then ending up being cute. And I was thinking that I have this thing in me that I do know that has this sort of, broader appeal. Like I was saying with that read aloud group, you could tell that there was a sense of humor that was connecting with them. But, I would have to edit out the terrible things, like even in that Halloween video, the thing that I didn't cut out, that awful line about women in slutty Halloween costumes out there looking for the fuck that's going to make them feel like a kid again, which I've gone deeper into as far as what I think I meant by that, but you wouldn't be able to say things like that and reach any kind of level commercial appeal, right? Like, and even like in Dead Cinema, I noticed that my partner Jason, the other Jason, it was like anytime anybody complimented him on anything, he would do the opposite, and you realized that it was all just a big exercise in reverse psychology. You couldn't ever tell him that you liked what he did because in his head, it's like, it's almost like the imp of the perverse, or, being a contrarian and trying to Somehow that connects in people's minds to the idea of artistic integrity. You don't want to please everyone. You want to please yourself, you know?
Right, yeah. That's overcompensatory, I would say. Like, if you are shown to be actually provoking people and upsetting them or deliberately not giving them what they want, then there's no chance that you're possibly doing the opposite.
Yeah.
But it erases the middle, which is just that you really are doing what you want without thought of the audience at all, and it may please them or it may displease them.
Okay.
Well, without thought of the audience doesn't mean without referring to the audience. Bring it full circle now. Because one can do something that's organic and natural, and it's not, one isn't thinking of the audience, but then one can check afterwards, well, did you like it? What did you think? What did you like? And just because, why wouldn't you? It's a dialogue.
Right. But what's the relationship between that kind of uncompromising, don't give them what they want thing and self-sabotage, you know?
Absolutely. Well, that's what I think for myself, that my tendency has been to, I suppose it's, I was thinking it was different. Well, I think it is different because I'm more likely to sense and things that people will like than things that people, well, I mean, I know you're saying that about Jason, but I don't think it's the same, the other Jason. But I mean, recently I've I felt like taking more risks by writing and speaking more openly about the importance of love, because I have been censoring that part. Like, I don't want to get mistaken for a Hallmark card.
Right.
It does. And so, and also, you know, I don't want to speak, if you're going to speak about things like that, you really want to be authentic. Like, it's
right,
it seems more like the more you're speaking about your heart, the more you want to be speaking from the heart. Now, I think we should always speak from the heart, whatever we're talking about, but I guess there are deeper layers of the heart. So if you're going to talk about movies, you don't have to go very deep into your heart to speak from your heart about them. But if you're going to speak about, yeah, love and how important it is in one's life, then you're aiming to get to the very center of oneself and expose that, and even the need to love and to be love and to feel love, to speak of that. Obviously, that by definition is scary because you're making yourself absolutely vulnerable in a way that I'm not if I diss Peter Lavender. Now, I'm more likely to get attacked for dissing Peter Lavender. I don't think I diss him, really. I think I just deconstruct him and expose him as the charlatan that he is. But anyway, one man's dissing is another man's analysis. It's risky in the sense I'm more likely to get attacked, but it's not going to hurt as much. As if I'm actually writing about my deeper most feelings and somebody comes and takes a shit on it, I'm really going to get upset. But actually, people won't. I mean, they might if I was famous, because then people would envy me and hate me and want to bring me down, and they'd see a weakness and attack. But if one isn't famous and one isn't a threat, you know, in that way, then speaking from a deep place and being vulnerable is actually going to, people will like that, particularly if you've already laid a foundation that, you know, isn't fluffy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I think that's an interesting counterpoint, that, or maybe it's an agreement with what you're saying, that there's been something in me that's self-sabotaging and self-censoring in terms of actually showing myself more fully and expressing myself more fully, that I definitely want to override. It's not just about being able to say things that will upset people, it's also about being able to say things that will make people happy and make people trust me.
Mm-hmm. Do you think all this ties into what you feel you're not getting from the ending of Notes from the Uncanny Valley?
Well, I'm sure it does, and I didn't want to just answer really quickly and too glibly there, but I'm sure it does is the quick answer. But I hadn't thought about it, I don't think exactly in those terms, because it was a feeling of it wasn't complete, and the experience of reading it wasn't complete. And so therefore, of course, something was missing. And then it's only been over time that we've talked more about it, and I've made this suggestion and that suggestion, and the most recent suggestions I've made have been moving in this direction, haven't they? Like I've been saying, well, actually, I'd like to see more about this character's inner life that isn't just mental rumination.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was thinking, you know, there's the only time that I'm fluffy in the book is when I'm writing about Stranger here, you know, my fluffy friend.
Well, I was saying for me, I mean, any time I was able to be heartfelt, you know, the word sentimental came to mind, and that's the very thing I was vowed never to be in my life. And I'm sure I have been in different ways, but I've never been in obvious ways because of that fear of being sentimental. But some people might see my writing about Gabanza as sentimental, I suppose. But anyway, that was the only times in the past that I was able to speak really from the heart in that way about love and loss, and was around my relationship with Kat, and that reflected my life as well. Like Gabanza was the only one that I could really
connect with.
Well, yeah, I was going to, you know, qualify it a bit more, but that'll do.
It's almost like, you know, it's almost like society saying, hey, Christmas is the time for intimacy. This is our culturally sanctioned. And if you want an ecstatic experience, there's a church here on this corner and there's a bar here on that corner. You know, and it's almost like we've decided that pets we're allowed to, I mean, talk about self-censorship. Like, you know, if you're out there trying to meet the love of your life or whatever, you know, if you're dating and you're, the level of self-censorship that happens in those dynamics. But, you know, when you're alone with an animal and there's that kind of purity of experience, and, you know, it's almost like your wife saying about when she was a child in the adult world, or the idea that autistics prefer interacting with robots because there's no unconscious.
Yeah.
No, an animal's never going to lie to you, you know? I mean, I guess you could, you know, one of the things that is kind of interesting about a relationship with an animal, you always wonder, like, are you just being sweet to me because, you know, I'm going to feed you soon? And, you know, but that, even that's not a lie, right? Like,
No, I never really wondered that with Gabanza. Yeah, I love receptacles. Because it's, I mean, I think what gets talked about less with animals or love in general is how much we need to give our love to someone.
Mm-hmm.
Not just feel loved by. when we pet an animal or play with a dog or cat, but you know, when we interact with an animal in that way, we're really dosing them up with love and getting to feel love ourselves, because it's coming through us, transmission is strong, and so we feel, not that we feel loved, we feel loving, which I think is more precious an experience even than feeling loved, although of course you want both, they're complementary.
Sure. In caretaking, it's like there was this period of my life where I was very depressed, and you know, it's like when you have to get out of bed because you have to feed this animal that you love, you know, it gives you a reason to exist. You know? I mean, maybe, you know, that's why some people have kids, which is never a great reason to have kids, you know, to give them a sense of purpose. But, you know, definitely with an animal, it's like, well, I might as well just stay in bed if, you know.
Well, no, I think it's valid. I mean, not as a reason to have kids, I'd agree with that part, but living, I guess the difference between living for others and living through others, and of course even living for others generally isn't clean, and it is a kind of living through others. I never trusted Mother Teresa in that particular regard, or generally, you know, philanthropists and do-gooders, even if they're not, don't have Rockefeller for their last name, have always seemed distrustworthy to me. Mm-hmm. But I'm getting to experience this as a thrift store, like it's the failed misanthrope, it's the reluctant philanthropist, the more I experience being loving towards others is just a practical approach to the circumstances and not some virtue thing that I think I should do, and not a feeling of wanting to please people. You know, there's nothing except this. This is just more authentic, more practical. It's more authentic to give people a positive experience of being here, better for business, obviously, but I'm not saying that's the primary incentive. It's better for me. I actually am starting. It's like the scales are tipping, and I'm starting, well, maybe it won't last, but recently starting to enjoy actually being warm and friendly more than being grouchy.
Wow, that's you.
Yeah. Did you say that's huge?
Yeah, that's a milestone, right?
I think that's what my wife says. Well, maybe not word for word. It, potentially, I don't want to jinx it, you know, by getting celebratory and, ooh, look, I'm changing, because just, you know, I just noticed it last time. Oh, like I can just as easily, well, it wasn't even that, but just something in me chose to override the desire to be a bit, you know, grumpy, override it and actually be the other way. And oh, that felt good. It didn't feel fake.
We're getting soft in our old age.
Yeah. It's too bad I can't get flexible along with that. Because getting soft and stiff at the same time. Anyway, I got 10 years, 12 years, 13 years on you, so you ain't seen nothing yet.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. I can't wait.
I hear a voice that's not my own that tells me to jump into the sea. Tired of listening to these words, I know they aren't meant for me. I know they aren't meant for me. I won't listen.
Alright, that's the end of that conversation with Gib Strange. I just made it one big file this time because, well, it's easier for me. I'm continuing with my live YouTube meets. Last one was on Sunday at 1 o'clock. The next one will be, I think, most likely on Saturday at 11 a.m. Pacific time, is what I'm thinking currently. Subscribe to my channel if you want to participate in those meetings. I'm lining up some podcasts for the coming weeks, some interesting and exciting guests, I think. We shall see if that pans out. So stay tuned, keep commenting, keep giving your support, your feedback, and your donations are greatly appreciated. And, well, I wouldn't be here without you. Anymore. These words, these words are yours. These words, these words are yours. From when you are born, everything you are told becomes you without your choice. Some point they become the family of one that speaks with only one voice. Speak with only one voice.